It's Outshow 111, but there's no Rob and there's no Kate. It's the stand-in crew instead. I'm Simon Minty, and with me is Shannon Murray.
And it's good to be here, though I think the stand-in crew have been given a tough gig. Today, listeners, we'll mostly be covering religion and politics. If you've seen it advertised, Guide Gods, that's not an unfortunate typo, it's a show about disability and religion. Writer and performer Claire Cunningham is here to tell us more.
And the politics bit? If Scotland were to become independent after the September the 18th referendum, how might that affect disabled people? We'll be talking it through in about half an hour.
And added to that, we've got our usual quiz, music, and one of our citizen correspondents coming up. So it's not all controversy and fighting.
Don't go away now.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
Hey, hold up, hold up. Can we get a new jingle there? It feels like some sort of summer excuse, but it's not. Rob is off globetrotting, and sadly, Kate is actually sick.
Yes, and you've got us instead, and we've already had an interesting start today, haven't we, Simon?
Yes, I arrived in the production office, and we had a guest we didn't plan on.
Yeah, we had a little mouse running around the office. Any stories you may have heard about mice in BBC buildings, we can advise you, they're true.
It was really, really tiny. I mean, what, a couple
it was
of
cute.
Inches, 6 centimetres?
And in case anyone's worried, it was taken care of in a nice and humane way. It was just escorted off the premises, but still alive.
But in that lovely way that probably would have been in that W1A BBC spoof comedy show. There was six people.
Simon, it's not a comedy, it's a docudrama.
But the security guy was kind of all blush. And then
when
he saw it, he ran out of the room.
Yeah, we actually stayed in the room. He ran in, screamed and ran out again. Anyway, joining us today in a role listed as presenter's friend is Mick Scarlett.
Hello, yes, I promise I'll be gentle with you.
Hi there, Mick. And on the line in our Glasgow studios, we're going to bring her in now. It's the aforementioned Claire Cunningham, she of the religion show Guide Gods. Hi there, Claire.
Hi there.
That's quite a clever little pun you've got going on there.
Thank you. Yeah, see what I did there?
We're going to talk about your show in a few minutes, though. But first up, it's time for Ouch News. Welcome to Ouch News, where we recruit correspondents from the Ouch listenership who can bring us passion and knowledge from their corner of the disability world. We have one of our citizen journalists on the line with breaking news. You've heard it before. It's our Cures correspondent, Jocelyn Tompkinson in Vancouver. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi, Simon.
How are you?
Great, great. It's a beautiful day here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And it's still a bit sunny here. So now, drugs, they're important to me and lots of our listeners in this show. We're talking about prescription, medication type drugs. You've got news of how taking fewer drugs can actually be more effective, which sounds counterintuitive. How is this?
Well, a lot of people with disabilities take medications orally, like a pill into their mouth that goes into your system. It takes a long time to dissolve and to get to the tissues in your body that you really need it to. And so for a long time, scientists have been using something called implantable pumps. And these are devices that are partially or completely implanted under your skin. But the new news today is that scientists have made a lot of progress in terms of microchip pumps for drug delivery that go just under the skin and require almost no thought or intervention once they're implanted. And they're being used right now for the treatment of osteoporosis.
Jocelyn, this sounds a little bit scary. I know they put caffeine in, didn't they? That was meant to sort of speed up. But this sounds a big leap. I mean, how does this actually work? How big are these pumps you're talking about?
The interesting thing is that I actually have one, but mine's old technology. Mine's about the size of a hockey puck, and it's implanted under the skin of my abdomen. And I use it for treating pain and muscle spasms. But the new ones that have just been tested are about the size of a postage stamp, if anyone even remembers what a postage stamp is.
Yeah.
And so they're, you know, just a couple of centimeters on each side, and they sit just under the skin, and they run completely on their own In fact, they're kind of ingenious. They use a really, really small electrical charge that melts a chamber that allows a small amount of, in this case, it's an anabolic drug that has to be taken very regularly to prevent the worsening of osteoporosis.
So go back a step. First of all, I can't believe you've got something the size of a hockey puck inside you. That sounds quite big and cumbersome. But the new technologies you described, that reminds me, is it the same principle as the nicotine patches, you know, which you'd put on your arm and you leave them there and they just sort of give a slow release of nicotine, as I understand it? Is this the same, but these are going in under the skin?
In some ways, yes. And in fact, that patch approach is what they're using for the delivery of insulin in these sort of microchip pumps, where you get a 1 week patch that sits on your skin that holds the insulin and diffuses it over a really controlled period of time into your skin and into your body. But these microchip pumps actually are implanted using a little bit of local anesthetic just Thanks. Under your skin. And all of the drug is inside the chip. So, you know, if someone were to look at you, they wouldn't even know that you had it.
Yeah.
And it allows, you know, a tiny amount of a drug to sort of diffuse into the tissues around the little pump. And this case, it's like into the fat of your belly.
So just jumping in, this, you said this can be a week, it could be longer. I mean, Mick, what do you think of this idea? Do you take medication?
I take medication. Yes. Many years ago, I was offered a similar pump, but they said that they would place mine in my testicles, giving me a third Ooh. Testicle. Apparently, this is what they do with guys. Apparently, all they did back then. And I said, no, thank you, because I didn't want to have to explain that in certain situations. So I stuck to just taking it orally. Yeah, I don't know what I think about this. It's kind of the advance of technology can be quite concerning. I think that sometimes medicine thinks it's found an answer for things without actually asking us if we actually have a problem to be solved. But I suppose for people that have got such a vast well of drugs inside them, the idea of having something the size of a postage stamp instead of something the size of a hockey puck is much more preferable.
So, Jocelyn, the main bit, is it people who use insulin? Or for me, I might take 4 or 5 painkillers every day. So the idea is that you just don't have to keep taking... This is about pain relief, insulin. Are there other areas?
Well, osteoporosis is one, and that prevents the deterioration of the bones. If you think about someone who has to take a drug to prevent the worsening of osteoporosis, mm-hmm. they have to take an injection every single day without failure. They have to always take it or it won't work. It's the same with insulin. It's a life-saving drug and they can't miss a dose. For me, I took a lot of pain meds and a lot of medications to treat muscle spasms, and I had to take enough that it would be effective when I was taking them orally, you know, taking a pill in my mouth. And that's just not as efficient a system as delivering a medicine right to, say, your bloodstream or right into your tissues. You can take a much smaller amount of the drug to be just as effective mm-hmm. With way fewer side effects.
There's a lot of positives to that for sure.
That's one of the really big issues, is the fact that side effect, when you take a lot of medicine orally, you end up having to take more things. Like if you take pain medicine, you'll end up with problems with stomach ulcers. So you'll obviously end up taking more drugs. So it is quite a good step forward.
But definitely. So just moving on to your other story, Jocelyn, I believe a particular internet craze has grabbed your attention this week, the ice bucket challenge. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I think you would have had to have been living in a cave to miss this one. So the ice bucket challenge has sort of swept social media. It was sort of a trend that was common in the sporting world. And then a young man with ALS, or motor neuron disease, he challenged other baseball players, because he was a college baseball player. He challenged the Boston Red Sox.
This was Peter Freites. He was diagnosed with ALS at a young age, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter Freites. He used to be a Boston College baseball player. And there's a lot of sort of brotherhood among athletes in the States. And I think that he challenged professional baseball players to give $100 to ALS, or motor neuron disease, research or be doused with icy cold water. Very quickly thereafter, it became a huge craze. And to their credit, there was no or. People started dousing themselves with icy cold water and donating to ALS research and challenging their friends to do likewise, and it just burned up the internet.
And do you think it has raised awareness of ALS in the States and motor neuron disease over here in the UK?
So that's the interesting question. Almost as soon as this craze became hot, you know, there were voices of critics from all corners saying, we're so tired of this. It's not going to do anything anyway. You know, basically get off the bandwagon. But here's the interesting thing. For some conditions, awareness actually does have an independent benefit. For example, for conditions like cervical cancer, where getting tested early can save your life, awareness actually matters. In this condition, in this case, a motor neuron disease can't be prevented and early testing can get you some early treatment, but it's probably not going to save your life. That benefit of awareness isn't necessarily going to happen. But I think we've seen some examples of how this campaign has really opened some doors for people living with this condition. A really good example is a story shared on Upworthy of a young man who lost his grandmother to this condition. Uh-huh. His mother is dying of this condition, and he was just diagnosed with it himself. His name is Anthony Carbajal. And Upworthy shared his story with millions of people. And as he said, he's never in his life seen people willing to talk about such a serious and you know, really sometimes disturbing condition.
In the US, the LAS Association is saying that they've actually had donations go up by more than $20 million. So that's definitely a big impact.
That was a slight worry of mine because it when I see it, I don't always see that there's a direct connection to supporting a charity or awareness and so on. It's just people having fun and going out there. And we have criticisms of certain sort of telethons or things like that where people are just having a great time, but they forget about it the next day. I mean, if there's some money going, then maybe. But it's a tricky one, this sort of awareness raise. You're looking at me quizzically, Mick.
I always think that we get a bit precious, I think, that we kind of worry about, oh, it's not serious. And it's like, wouldn't disability be great if it was not serious? If just for once we could be considered to be fun, you know? I mean, the whole idea of raising awareness about various conditions is really important. I mean, I was born with a very rare type of cancer. And even today, it's very, very difficult to treat, mainly because no one knows about it. There's only 100 cases worldwide each year. So I do a lot to raise the profile so that doctors and parents know what to look for. And if I could think of a really fun way of doing that, I would. So if you've got any ideas, please contact the show.
A lovely surprise for you, Mick. We've got an iced bucket of water. Just come in now.
Not with my hair.
Claire, have you seen this on the internet?
I've been aware of it. I haven't actually watched any of them. I've kind of resisted just because of the celebrity factor just kind of put me off.
I mean, do you feel that, I mean, because I did ask this question last week on Twitter, that was it actually working to raise awareness? Because it feels like the celebrities are getting more coverage than the actual condition. And, you know, people standing up putting an ice bucket of water for themselves is great, but not all of them are saying, here's a number to donate to, here's a website, follow through. I kind of want to see a little bit of proof that people have donated, not just stood there and poured some icy water over themselves.
I felt a little bit the same as well of going, are these people actually putting money to it?
Exactly.
And are they actually instigating their fans to do that? Or is it just a bit of
I would say, and I feel now I need to make a donation, but there is the best video I've seen of this was the one where they go wrong. And there's a whole bundle of people who, they miss their head, they pour it over a dog, something just goes wrong, and it is a joy. It's so funny.
We'll raise some awareness for those. Just before
because we can't do it because it'll ruin our wheelchair. So unless we get out of our chair and do it, no way am I pouring ice on my wheelchair, it'll rust, and that's the end of that.
Just before we let you go, Jocelyn, I'm not sure if you're aware, but Scotland are voting on whether or not to become independent of the UK. Is much of that getting any news coverage in Canada?
I have to say no, but Canadians could really identify, I think, with the situation because we've had now two referendums about the secession of Quebec, which is our French-speaking province.
Right.
So while I haven't heard anything about it, you know, best wishes to all, and I hope you all sort it out and remain the jolly old UK.
Very good answer, Jocelyn. Well ducked. It is now time for you to sign off.
Thank you, Jocelyn.
I've been Jocelyn Tompkinson, Cures correspondent, reporting for Ouch News.
So, just to tot up, we've got a TV correspondent, a Cures correspondent, an assistance animals correspondent, and loads more. So what's your particular interest within disability, and could you be a correspondent for us too? Email ouch at bbc.co.uk or tweet us at bbcouch and tell us what it is. And we may hear you on a future show.
You're listening to Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Simon Minty and Shannon Murray. Coming up...
I am human. I feel
that was I Am Human by Ilsa, and you can hear it in full at the end of the show.
Now, let's turn to Claire up in Glasgow. Claire Cunningham is soon to perform her latest show in London. It's called Guide Gods. And in it, she explores how the major world's faiths view deafness and disability. Her website describes it as witty and illuminating. Tell us more, Claire.
It really kind of started actually last year, so kind of January 2013. And I went on a trip out to Cambodia because I was actually planning to make a performance around landmines. So I went out there to research that because I kind of thought of landmines as being objects that created crutch users. Myself, and that was my kind of tentative connection and fascination. And I was basing my research around interviewing people who were landmine survivors or disabled people as well, generally in Cambodia, because it has one of the highest percentage in the world of disabled people. So curious about what the situation was in the country generally. And in among my interviews, we went to a school, a really beautiful school for children with physical impairments in Phnom Penh, and met a teacher there who had formerly been a Buddhist monk, and he was a physically impaired adult. He'd had polio as a child, and he told us a couple of things. He told us, firstly, that he'd been a Buddhist monk for about 5 years, but that he wasn't supposed to be a Buddhist monk because he was disabled.
Right.
That he was told that... he wasn't really allowed to be to be a Buddhist monk as a disabled person, but they allowed him in to avoid conscription into the army and then defrocked him.
Wow.
And so that was one thing that was quite surprising to hear.
Can I just ask what his disability actually was?
So he had a kind of physical impairment. He didn't use crutches, but he still had a kind of movement difficulties left over from having had polio.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And he was a teacher in the school, which was great. A lot of the teachers were disabled individuals themselves. And the other thing that he mentioned to us was that he attributed his impairment and his disability to karma.
Right,
to the idea
that he actually believed.
Yeah, that it was related to something bad that he'd done in a previous life.
So is this a little bit like when Glenn Hoddle got into trouble about 15 years ago with similar statements?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I think Glenn Hoddle was kind of following a mix of different things that were all mixed together and following one particular sort of spiritual advisor. But this guy was very specifically Buddhist.
Right.
And his name, fantastically, was Mr. Wrong.
Nice.
I know, you couldn't make it up. And I realised when I was sitting there kind of interviewing him that I just didn't know how to engage with that perspective, this belief that he thought he was disabled because of something he'd done in a past life.
And where else did you travel to?
I also, about 3 months later, I was then in Qatar, which was the first time I'd really been in a Muslim country. And the other thing then, because of the experience in Cambodia, I then kind of consciously asked, you know, where is the perspective on disability coming from here?
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that, well, really, children and adults, disabled adults, are still quite hidden away there. It's still considered quite shameful on the person and their families. So it's still it's quite a hidden thing. And I, you know, in my ignorance and naivety, was kind of curious as to whether this was somehow related to Islam or whether that it was having an effect on why people were hidden away. Was there something within Islam that kind of perpetuated that notion of shame? And so kind of coming back to Scotland, it began to kind of, it kept kind of going round my head, these questions of what were these different faiths or spiritual journeys as spiritual beliefs as Buddhism is, I guess. What were their actual perspectives on disability, and how were they affecting people? Yeah. And it just made me incredibly conscious of my own ignorance more than anything, and that I knew nothing about how different faiths might view disability.
And Mick, when you've travelled around the world, how have you found other religions or cultures dealing with disability? What's your experience?
Funnily enough, it's strange because the Buddhist angle, I fully understood from Buddhist friends I knew that actually they believed that disabled people had achieved Godhead, reached Nirvana, and decided, rather than become one with Godhead, to come down as disabled people to give all the rest of the world a chance to improve their karma.
Yeah.
And actually, the way you treat disabled people indicates what kind of person you are. We don't care, because we're going straight back to heaven anyway, because we've already done it. And so the idea that I think this is one of the things about religion is, depending on who you talk to, depends on what religion says. Some people say that God's testing you. Other people say God's punishing you. And really, it just proves it's all a load of rubbish. But there you go. That's because I'm a massive atheist. And that's because throughout my life, I've met loads of people who have genuinely condemned me for not believing. I remember when I was 15 and my spine collapsed and I went in a wheelchair, I was in a ward full of children who were all newly disabled, a couple were dying. It was a really scary ward. And I remember a priest coming in on a Sunday and saying, right, everyone, we're now going to pray. And we all went, get out of it. And he went, you all deserve to be disabled. It's God's punishment for non-belief. And I thought, well, if that's what your religion says, you can shove it.
It is. I mean, disability and religion sometimes can be quite uneasy bedfellows. Mm. And there's a... sometimes I'm generalising here, but there's that sort of potential patronising or people praying for us when we might not actually want that. I mean, did you come across this, Claire? Is it kind of the pity thing that you were trying to understand, and maybe that was your resistance to religion?
Or
presumably you found some people who were very enlightened and okay.
Yeah,
about.
I mean, absolutely. As Mike says, it's completely dependent from person to person. You know, even if they're theoretically of the same faith, they can have a completely different perspective on it. But I think that my own, you know, inevitably my own questions around how I felt about religion were part of the kind of creating the performance, and I became quite aware that I don't follow a religion myself. I don't particularly believe in a god. And I think it is related to encounters with individuals, you know, doing the same thing of coming up and offering prayers, etc. And as I grew older and a bit more sort of politically aware, I found that more and more offensive, you know, and found it more a sort of something about also not only just the way I was being perceived, but the fact that I was expected to compromise my own beliefs
Absolutely.
To accommodate someone else's. And so there was a lot of questions for me in around that, in terms of what within particular faiths might be considered sort of selfless acts, and whether they're actually really about the person being prayed for, or if they're actually more about making the person doing the praying feel better or get into heaven, and these sorts of things, you know, I was curious about. And
if you go back, I mean, I'm trying to think of the history of disability, particularly in the UK, and I would imagine there's a lot of religious people who got involved in the early days to set up charities and organisations. Obviously, it's changed to a certain extent, but there's still echoes of it around. But I'm just jumping back. I remember being in Karachi in Pakistan and speaking with a bunch of very well-educated people. And I said, but, you know, I'm short, I'm 3'11", can't move around, and da, da, da. And they were saying, well, that is, you know, that's God's will and that's part of the so on. And I said, but do you not think it could be genetic? And they all went, oh, yeah, we know it is genetic, but we're not really allowed to say that publicly. And I just thought this is a really interesting bit, because there's science has sometimes moved on, which will conflict with a certain view, but I don't know.
So, I mean, I always think it's funny, because you do get this kind of thing where lots of religions seem to go, oh, you poor thing. And yet, at the same time, if you believe that whatever God you believe in made everything, then he made us too. Mm. We're part of it. We're part of what he was planning.
Yep.
So the idea... So we should not be pitied or looked down on, or that we won't be punished. If God made everything, he made us. It's not a sign that he's had a bad day, you know, which is kind of how you feel. And I also think one of the really funny things is, I don't know about you, but how many times have your friends told you, don't worry, we're praying for you when you're not well? And it's like... So what? So if I get better, it's you that God did it. That God made me better. It's nothing to do with me. And if I'm ill, it's normally my fault.
I've got this thing that if somebody says, you know, I'm praying for you, I just think, well, that's really nice. If that makes you feel better, that's great. I'm not bothered either way. Mm. But, you know, that's time out of your day. So I don't see it as offensive. I don't see it as pitying. I just see it as that's their choice, and that's actually what gets them through the day to feel good about themselves. And it's the same thing if somebody stops me in the street and, you know, they just go, oh, I'm praying for you. That's great. If anything, I pity them more because of their ignorance and narrow-mindedness that they think just because I'm in a wheelchair, I need their prayers. But if they're going to pray, that's fine. They can knock themselves out.
Can it be both? There's the guy who's just recovered from Ebola in the US, and he comes and says, this science has been unbelievable, and I did the first treatments, and I knew that God had saved me and people had been praying for me. So he's kind of combining the two quite happily.
That's fine. Whatever gets you through, that's absolutely fine.
We hijacked you there,
Claire. Sorry, Claire.
I'll just let you do the show.
I think you're your artistic director.
So, guide gods, what can people expect to see if they actually come along? How have you got this to, like, you know, feed into the actual show itself?
Oh, well, yeah, well, that was a bit of a nightmare. How on earth do you make this into a show? There's a reason people don't make shows about religion, because it's a nightmare. And everybody comes with their own ideas of what they think it should say, sure. I think, or at least I felt like people were going to come with their own. Everyone's got an opinion. So what the piece became was that I knew I wanted to make it using interviews. So and actually the accounts of people that I spoke to, rather than it being me on a soapbox for an hour, particularly in my own ignorance. So it was very much sort of I went and did a lot of interviews and took audio recordings. So the show is made up with sort of my journey through meeting these people and their own voices being played in the recording, in the performance. It's come out of movement work. So there's dance, there's song, because my own only relationship with religion really is as a singer, is singing. They've got great tunes, but...
Can I just jump in, Claire? And do you, from your research, this might sound a little bit trite, but did you come away saying, you know what, that's the religion that I like, or was there one that spoke to you?
What's the pro-disability religion? Which one should we all be with?
Oh. Top of the pops for religion.
Yeah. Best religion to have.
I couldn't say what one particularly came out. I mean, it was really funny because I was so... You know, I knew so little about some of these faiths that my mentor, Tom, every time I spoke to him, said I was basically just seduced by whoever I spoke to last. So I'd be like, oh, my God, I've just been speaking to this Hindu lady and Hinduism's amazing. And then the next week it would be like, oh, I just spoke to this Islamic person about Islam and it's wonderful. And I was just at the Sikh temple at the Gurdwara and it's great. You get all this food and all the fat, you know, so there's... What I came away with was there are elements within them all that I find really admirable and really beautiful. I wouldn't say that there was one that I felt I gravitated towards particularly, but I came away with a kind of a better understanding a little bit of different faiths, but also, yeah, there were things within each that I thought, oh, I like that. And I find like what I enjoyed throughout them all was the fact that I think having a religion perhaps is in terms of the one thing I might miss out on is that it certainly instills in a lot of people the sense of thinking of others before themselves,
right?
Which I'm very not like that. me
all the best bits and make your own.
Yeah, well, there was that
possibility.
That's
a really good way of making some serious money.
So you could be a guru rather than a performer. So
exactly.
Guide Gods is on at the South Bank Centre in London on the 2nd or 3rd of September. So thank you very much and do stay here with us.
This is Out, Disability Talk from the BBC with me, Simon Minty, and Shannon Murray. In a little while, it's our quiz of the month, and we do like a good quiz. But now we're moving on to our next subject. We've dealt with religion, and now we're moving on to politics. Should Scotland be an independent country? That's the question being asked of all people over 16 in a referendum in Scotland on September the 18th. It's been talked about for years, and with the rise in popularity of the Scottish National Party in recent times, a referendum has now been agreed.
Scotland has had its own parliament and government since 1999, but shares power with the government in London. Scotland controls the Scottish NHS, has its own legal system, and has other distinct powers, including the ability to vary income tax a little, though it has not chosen to alter it yet. In Scotland, there are no prescription charges, and famously, there are no student tuition fees. Just one vote above 50% in favour will change the future of Scotland.
So how, if at all, might independence affect disabled people? On the line, we've got two disabled Scottish residents. Pippa Riggs is about to start a degree and is opposed to Scotland becoming independent. Hi there, Pippa.
Hi.
And John McArdle, who might be on a bit of a difficult line, we believe, but hopefully we can hear him. John is the co-founder of the Black Triangle campaign, who are in favour of an independent Scotland. Hi there, John.
Hi there.
So let's start with you, Pippa. Obviously, we're a disability show, so we're keen on that angle. But why would you be voting no to independence?
I just don't think it's appropriate. I was born British and I want to remain British.
And are there particular policies that are influencing your decision, making you lean towards a no vote?
Basically, from what I understand, the SNP are wanting a lot of bilateral communication and resource sharing with the rest of the UK once they have independence. Despite this, if there is a no vote and Scotland remains a part of the UK, they're going to be given greater powers under what was going to be called Devo Max anyway.
Right. And as a disabled person, I know that there's been some people who are saying that the yes vote will lead to better changes that be more positive for disabled people. Does that have any bearing on your decision?
Not at all, because there's no real solid evidence. I spoke to a researcher over at the Yes campaign to make sure I had my facts in line before coming on, and he confirmed there is no solid mandate post-Independence Day in Scotland for welfare reforms other than keeping work capability assessments in the public domain and possibly giving carers an extra £550-odd a year, which with inflation would, I mean, the time 2016 comes around, it's probably not going to be far off that extra £550 anyway.
Right.
OK, let's bring John in and I hope we can hear you. John, tell us why you're going to be voting yes for independence.
Well, over the past 4 years since this government came into power, disabled people have been under systematic attack through the work capability assessment carried out by ATOS for the DWP, which has been reassessing disabled people using a functional assessment. And hundreds of thousands of people have lost their allowances, only to have them reinstated after lengthy waits to go to tribunal service. It's a national scandal. Soon there will be the reassessment of disabled people in receipt of DLA for the new personal independence payment, which is a much stricter regime. And it's expected that in Scotland, out of the 190,000 existing DLA claimants, 105,000 working age disabled people will lose all their disability benefits by 2018. With a loss of 1,120 per year.
So, John, I mean, I wouldn't dispute the sort of the thrust, but does the SNP or is there a guarantee that's not going to happen in Scotland? That's, I guess, what I'm saying. If there's austerity measures, will that never happen in Scotland with an SNP?
Well, we've got the white paper. I mean, if we look at the record of the SNP government. They've done an awful lot to mitigate the welfare reforms. Mm-hmm. For example, they set up a £33 million Scottish Welfare Fund to provide crisis grants. When crisis grants were scrapped, well, crisis loans, as they were scrapped. The council tax reduction scheme was introduced in Scotland in 2013 to replace the abolition of council tax benefit and provide the same level of support to vulnerable people, including disabled people. Over the years 2013 to 14 and 14 to 15, the Scottish Government is investing £55 million to mitigate the impact of the bedroom tax, where it's estimated that 80% of affected households contain a disabled person.
Pippa,
yes.
Were you chipping in there?
Yeah, as I said, the SNP aren't planning on getting rid of WCAs, so to say voting yes would resolve that, it's not a feasible argument. WCAs will still exist.
John, do you have any comment on that?
Because if you read the white paper on Scotland's future. It's pledged, and it's come straight from the Deputy First Minister's mouth, that the WCA will be scrapped, and also that private companies will be expelled from having anything to do with the reassessment of disabled people.
That's not what the
it's written there in black and white.
So it's just for those who
will be stopped in its tracks.
Just to, so we don't slip in the work capability assessment, the WCA, for those who may not know. I mean, that bigger picture, when we sort of heard about the debate between the yes and no camps, there was that big killer question about the currency, and part of the argument has been that there isn't really an economic sort of framework or absolute, there's no specifics. Now, a bit of me can get that, because you think, well, hang on, we haven't separated yet, and some of that's to be worked out. But I can also see that that could be a bit fearful as well. I mean, where are you at on this, Pippa? Are you a bit uncertain, or...?
The currency thing, to me, it's concerning. Alex Salmond hasn't really put out his plan B. He's rigidly saying that we will keep the pound and there will be a fiscal union between the rest of the UK. But by doing so, he wouldn't have as much control as he would like. So it kind of really questions, why are you going independent?
So, and also, I mean, the flip side of that, John, perhaps, is you remember in the UK the Lib Dems said no tuition fees and then they went back on it. Are you confident disabled people will, these promises are absolute and they're not going to be moved around?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that I'd rather take my chances with the Scottish Government at Holyrood than the one at Westminster. You know, obviously, as a campaign, we're intending to work closely with other organisations such as Inclusion Scotland to ensure that our rights are embedded in a written constitution. So, you know, we've always got to hold politicians to account.
And
I think most disabled folk would rather take their chances with a government which has a track record in mitigating the worst impacts of welfare reform and has made it a primary pledge in this campaign to guarantee the rights of disabled people and inclusion in society than to stick with what we've got in Westminster. If we stick with what we've got.
And Pippa,
no
did you have
what's coming down the track?
Pippa, do you have any final words
to that? It's all well and good, the SNP and the Scottish Parliament giving us everything at the moment to show us how nasty the UK government has been. But once and if they become our supreme rulers, as it were, the shoe will be on the other foot. They will be the one having to watch their spending and possibly tightening their belt.
Right. And apologies to everyone for the bad lines we're having here. Claire, did you have anything you wanted to finish with? Obviously, you are from Scotland as well.
Yeah, it's been really beautiful to see the amount of debate and discussion and imagination that's been employed to bring people back into it. And, you know, just this idea of going, of suddenly thinking, if you could make your country anew, what would you want your country to look like? And it's been really wonderful, the discussions, just even if it doesn't happen,
Claire,
that people are given that opportunity to rethink, how do you want your country to be?
Absolutely. I think that it is, I mean, is it 300 years or something? That question about do you want to be in this or not? This is so huge compared to a general election. Again, our apologies for the quality of alignment, John. I hope you could hear it and follow it. So a big thank you both to John and Pippa. And thank you, Claire. We're getting you off the fence there. You're coming in. Thank you to our guests on Scottish independence.
Right. So moving away from religion and politics. Thanks for that, guys. What the producers thought would be a nice, relaxing and fun item to end each show is fast turning into the most shouty bit.
Mick
and Claire are still with us.
Sorry, Mick.
Claire, you will probably have to shout to get past Mick. And we'll now see who remembers most about disability news from the past month.
So, our first question. A pilot of a commercial airline was in the news this month thanks to an incident which occurred while he was landing a plane in Belfast. Anyone know about this?
His arm came off.
Yes, that's Claire. Wins that point.
Claire was very quick. And
it was a prosthetic arm, I'd like to point out.
OK. Do you know any, a little, can you fill us, well, those who haven't heard it, a little bit more about the story, Claire?
I believe he had some sort of fixture to the steering that he normally fastens his arm to, and somehow it became disjointed and there was a wee bit of turbulence maybe, but it was all landed safely, I believe.
Yes, it was landed safely, absolutely.
That actually happened to me once in my car. The hand controls dropped off my car. It didn't end nice. I smashed into a central reservation of a roundabout.
Because
you can't brake. It's gone. Yeah. You just roll into whatever's in front of you.
Mine dislodged and they were hanging loose, but I still managed to drive briefly.
This is just for those. It's a prosthetic arm, and he was the pilot. It became detached from the plane control. The Flybe, that was the airline. The pilot was landing at Belfast in gusty conditions, as you said, Claire, when this artificial limb, which was secured to the steering mechanism via a latching device, fell off. Now, I met a chap on a disability course a few years ago, and he had a prosthetic arm, left arm. And we got talking, and he said, "I wear this for other people, to put them at ease. I have no use for it. It's most of the time it gets in the way, but it makes other people relax." And I said, "Does it not have any functional use?" And he said, "Well, there is one, which is when I'm changing gear in the car, this is really helpful, because in the UK, it was you need your left arm to change gear." So cutting a long story short, he became a lot more confident, decided he didn't have to put a prosthetic arm on to make other people feel more comfortable. And in the end, he permanently attached this prosthetic arm onto the gear stick of his car. So he would get in the car, slot the rest of the arm in, and off he went. And that was the only time he ever used it.
The best anti-theft device in the world.
There's an arm. So moving on, we're...
Can I be cheeky, though?
Yeah, go on.
Do we feel worried that... This is what they were doing on the news. Is it a disabled pilot? I love the fact that there was a disabled pilot with one arm flying.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, used to.
I think that's a brilliant equality story.
And they did say we employ lots of pilots who have various different disabilities.
Yeah, I was more worried.
Prepare. Can see it now. So we'd all be flying that. You know, we'd all have the right amount of leg room. You'd all be able to get your chair in properly. There'd be no having to rush to the front of the queue to be let on right. And, oh, it'd be perfect. Grip air, that's the one for me.
Yeah, boarding would take 4 hours.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
Sorry. And moving away from flying, but still roughly flying and holidays, we're moving on to statistics and numbers. So in a recent survey looking at 52 of Britain's top 100 tourist attractions, which percentage of them were found not to be fully wheelchair accessible? So that was a bit wordy. So we're going with option A, 63% weren't wheelchair accessible. Option B, 84% were not wheelchair accessible. Or C, 36% weren't wheelchair accessible.
B.
You're going with 84%?
I am.
And Claire, you?
I think it was... I'm going to go with A.
63%. Once again, Claire's winning here. Yeah. Point to Claire.
But is that really wheelchair accessible, or is that access consultant wheelchair accessible, which of course means it's not really wheelchair accessible, but it's as wheelchair accessible as it needs to be to comply with the law. Mm. Sorry, it's my big bugbear at the moment.
That's all right.
I'm so
no,
sick
go
and
with
tired
it.
Of access consultants saying it's accessible, and what they mean is it's barely accessible, and it means that very few people can use it. It's not actually that comfortable, and really it's just a cheap way of saying, yeah, that'd do.
No, accessible should be 100% accessible without assistance. But this came out of an incident. A 14-year-old, Nicky Shepherd from Burnley, he has cerebral palsy, and he was turned away from Blackpool Pleasure Beach because of his disability. Apparently, even to the point where a member of staff said, if you can't walk unaided, then you can't go on the ride. So, I mean, you know, what's the deal here? Because a lot of the big parks all say that they're wheelchair accessible. People can get in. As we know, there have been people who've actually used wheelchairs to jump the queues.
In the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. And surely, you know, it's Nicky's choice. He knows his disability. He knows if it's safe for him to go on the ride. So surely, why can't we have the same autonomy and decision as anyone else?
Funnily enough, years ago, when I was famous, I was asked by Euro Disney to go and open Euro Disney to announce how accessible Euro Disney was. Then, years later, I thought, I know, I'll go to Euro Disney. I arrived in Euro Disney with a 3-day pass and was told as I walked through the door, sorry, sir, if you can't walk, you can't go on any of the rides. So it really is, things can change really quickly.
Yeah.
So
this was the same as this guy, because you're saying there's a ramp to get right up, but then it's sort of accessible.
But then it depends on how you implement the emergency escape plans, because what they mean is you can get on it in a wheelchair, but can you get off it if it breaks down? And the answer is, well, obviously not. But then they go, in that case, you can't go on the rides. And
Claire, have you had any incidents like this where there's, you know, insanity trying to dictate what can and can't happen with a disabled person?
Not so much. I think I use crutches, and I think yeah, I don't quite experience quite as much sort of madness.
Answer is to just say yes. When they go, can you walk a distance? You go, yeah, sure. And you get on the rise and you go on it, then you get off, get back in your chair, and it's fine. And if you can't walk, what are they going to do? They're going to make you get up and walk?
I did that the other day. I went on the train to Sheffield and I found out that I had to get a scooter pass for to get my scooter on, which you have to apply for separately. Kind of long story short, I did went through all the process. It didn't turn up. I got on the train, did the journey, came back. And then 3 days later, they sent me a letter saying, you've been refused the scooter pass. Your scooter isn't appropriate.
Oh my God.
And so you cannot travel on the train. I wrote back and said, I've already done it. What are you doing?
Your scooter's tiny.
Yes. Next question. Oh, what was the answer to that, by the way?
It was Claire was right, 63%.
I was wrong again.
Claire's
right. So,
good.
No answer and wrong answer. I won't be getting any A stars, will I?
Bear with me while I unpack this. In the world of disability, you might hear someone describe parts of their body as a little bit gammy. Gammy leg, gammy hand, gammy arm. We've all heard it. But why was gammy in the news this month?
We've obviously been too busy, haven't we?
Right.
That's what it is. We have no idea. Because of a lot of gam and steaks, I've no
okay,
idea.
Baby boy, is that a clue?
Baby boy?
Yes. No. Thailand?
Down
syndrome?
Claire's coming in.
The surrogate.
Again, Claire wins. That's a high score there.
It's about the surrogate, the Australian couple that had a surrogate
That's
mother
right.
in Thailand, and they took one twin but didn't take the child with Down syndrome.
Yep, that's right.
Gammy, that was the name, wasn't it?
Yeah,
sorry,
of the child.
What?
Heard this story?
No, well, I've heard the story, but I didn't realise they'd named the kid Gammy.
I think it means something else entirely.
I think this was a Thai name rather than
okay.
an actual referral to disability. I just think it's unfortunate rather than intentional.
Jeremy Clarkson probably named him or something.
Of course, Richard Dawkins will be all for that, won't he?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we can't really talk about Down syndrome this week without bringing up Mr. Dawkins. Mick, do you have anything you'd like to say?
It's one of the things that really upsets me in that I, as you know, as we've already mentioned, I am a bit of an atheist.
Yeah.
And yet it upsets me that more and more the atheist camp are turning into sort of micro-Nazis. And they all keep going on about sort of things that once upon a time we would have called eugenics. Mm. And now they're like, well, that's just rational. And so while I'm not religious, I find myself more and more siding with people who are religious because they seem to think that life is precious, life is wonderful, we should hang on to life, and that all life is sacred. And it's quite depressing for an atheist, who is quite as painfully atheist as I am, to be in this position.
I think you've hit something on
there's
the
There's a show
head.
In that for you there, Mick.
But, I mean, and it also links back to Claire's sort of discovering that, the religion and faith, there were some people about doing good and being good. But for those who didn't follow it was a tweet, wasn't it? What did Dawkins actually say?
Well, it was basically implied that it was sensible.
He said
to
abort it and try again.
Yeah.
If
you had Down syndrome, it was a rational and sensible choice to abort the baby and try again.
And the bit that he justified that was he was saying if you had autism, you bring and you contribute something to society. You may have a unique skill. Whereas if you have Downs, he said it didn't bring anything.
Well, we should actually give him credit because he did backtrack slightly in the past few days.
Oh, that's all right then.
I mean, this is such an awkward thing. I have this sort of belief that being short statured, having dwarfism, if there's this horrible hierarchy of disability, I always think people with Down syndrome are the sort of they're one step down the chain for me.
I always say this whenever I'm sort of, trying to fight for the rights of disabled people. I say, what we've got to remember is that we're all sitting here jumping up and down, and then in the corner, normally ignored, are all the people with learning disabilities, and we need to bring them on board because they, it's just so offensive and it's one of the things that so many people think. So many people say, oh, well, you can contribute, but those people can't. And it's absolutely and totally incorrect. If you don't know anyone and you don't know anything about it, keep your mouth shut.
Have you ever taken that approach, Mick?
Yes, believe it or not. If I don't know about something, I'll try to keep quiet.
I'm so sorry.
I'm so knowledgeable.
You are very knowledgeable, and I couldn't resist the tea.
Quickly, think of something I don't know anything about. Well, obviously the last month's news from the sound of it.
But we've got to finish this quiz. But that story, the original one, as it sort of unravelled, made me feel quite... Well, unbelievably uncomfortable. The more we found out about what was going on and the family and so on.
The Gammy story as opposed to the Dawkins story.
Sorry, yeah.
So we've covered the big three. We've done religion, we've done politics, we've done science.
That's it for show 111, with thanks to Emma Tracy and the studio manager, Nasser Prevez. The producer was Damon Rose. Next month, Rob and Kate return. Well, that's the plan, at least.
And I'm sure after today, you all can't wait for them to return. Music this month comes from Ilse, a one-handed Belgian-born singer-songwriter living in New York. She has shared the stage with Lana Del Rey and worked with producers who created tracks with R&B singer John Legend and Mercury Prize winner James Blake. The video for this song has already had over 300,000 YouTube hits, which Ilse puts down to its inclusive message.
Yeah, she says the song is in response to the quizzical looks and cruel bullying that she experienced having a prosthetic left hand while she was growing up in a small town. Links to the video will be on our blog, bbc.co.uk/ouch. This is Ilse with I Am Human. Goodbye.
We drift away when all we need.